Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Feeling empathy for an infant, recoiling in fear of a snake. These are but a couple of the hallmarks of evolution's effects on our brains. The study of our mental structure, as shaped over thousands and thousands of years, is called evolutionary psychology, and it was the subject of a recent interdisciplinary seminar held by the Whitaker Center here at FGCU. Dr. Nate Pipitone, who teaches psychology here at FGCU, hosted Dr. Glenn Gehr, the founding director of the Evolutionary Studies Program at SUNY in New Paltz, New York. I talked with both of them about this intriguing course of study, starting with Dr. Nate Pipitone talking about the lecture series itself and specifically about Dr. Gehr's presentation. Tell me a little bit about the lecture that happened this week.
So the Whitaker Center puts out a weekly, what they call STEMinar lectures, so weekly talks basically focusing on disciplines that are in the STEM area. And so different people from different departments and different perspectives are giving their talk on research and what they're doing in their labs. And the talks are geared for a general audience. And so we were lucky enough to have Dr. Glenn Gehr in for one of those talks.
So tell me quickly what STEM is, what that stands for.
It's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And so disciplines in that area, basically utilizing science to understand those different areas.
So that's what it is.
Yeah.
And it's just trying to get the general public involved and get them to, you know, come and listen to things
exactly.
that are of interest
so
to them.
Students, faculty, the general public, just kind of to know what at FGCU, what's going on in those STEM areas. Exactly.
And this particular talk was part of a series of these?
Yes. Yeah. The STEMinar series. So the Whitaker Center puts out weekly talks that can be found on their website. And we had Dr. Gehr in for his talk.
So this week was kind of exciting because we have Dr. Gehr, and I saw the news release that you put out, and I thought, oh, we have to talk to this person because what he's talking about is so interesting. Tell me about evolutionary psychology.
Yeah. So my work is as a scholar is essentially in the field of evolutionary psychology, which basically is looking at any aspect of human psychology, behavioral patterns, emotional states, cognitive processes from a Darwinian perspective. So we essentially from an evolutionary perspective, we essentially look at some behavioral pattern and we ask questions that we like to think of as ultimate questions or sort of big questions. You know, why did this process or why did this behavioral pattern evolve in the first place, which is similar to asking how would this have been adaptive for our ancestors in the African savanna, particularly before agriculture, which is we're talking about the lion's share of human evolution. So a clear example that people usually connect well with has to do with fear of snakes. So if you show people handgun, pictures of a handgun versus pictures of a snake, people are much more likely to show a visceral negative response to a snake rather than to a handgun. Whereas, as you know, in our society now, you're much more likely to die from a handgun than you are from a snake. And from an evolutionary perspective, we can step back and we can ask, well, under ancestral conditions, were snakes a major selective pressure or adaptive hurdle? Did a lot of our ancestors during human evolution die of snake bites? Well, one way we can think about that is to look at people now in nomadic groups in places like the South Pacific, South America, and Africa, and look at the nature of their life experiences. And it turns out that estimates are between 5% and 10% of people's cause of death in those societies is due to snake bite, giving you a sense of, okay, maybe that's why we would have evolved a pretty strong negative response to snakes, and partly why when we see a lot of different stimuli, like a stick in the grass, you might sort of say, whoops, okay, that's a stick, not a snake. Why we have that kind of bias.
Yeah, I know. I definitely have that. Is that something that is sometimes referred to in pop culture as the reptilian brain or the reptilian type response to things?
Yeah, yeah. The evolution of the brain can be thought about as sort of having some basic parts that we could talk about as being lower in the brain that sort of map onto what would have happened earlier in vertebrate evolution. And actually, I'd say that Nate's more of an expert on that particular topic.
What about that reptilian that phrasing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. So all of us, you know, humans are blessed with this higher cerebral cortex matter in our brains, which gives us conscious thought and conscious processing. But all of us still have that reptilian brain or lower conscious processes that control, that are more tightly controlled or linked to our emotional tendencies. So for example, all primates, I'm glad you guys mentioned this. So all primates have a specific area of their thalamus called the pulvinar region. And since all primates, this pulvinar region, I should explain that first. The pulvinar region dictates our reaction to snake stimuli. So in the lab, when you show images of snakes, the pulvinar neurons go boop, boop, boop. They go crazy. And the pulvinar neuron in the thalamus is the first stop for visual information coming in. So across primate taxa, you see this has been studied, you know, using, you know, pretty heavy neuroscience stuff. But all of us have those neurons. When they react, it shows a snake, and then it's directly linked into our fear system. So, you know, this tells us that, and it's only in primates, and all primates have had to deal with snakes in their evolutionary history. So other animals that have not had to deal with snakes don't have this large structure of their thalamus.
And is that like then the trigger of the fight or flight response?
It definitely could be, yes.
Which is another thing that I remember from when I studied science
exactly.
1,000 years ago.
So well, your thalamus will be responding to these threatening stimuli even before you're consciously aware of it. And that's definitely adaptive, to have your reptilian brain reacting to these stimuli, because if you had to be consciously aware of all the threatening things, we wouldn't be alive. So, you know, consciousness, in a sense, gets more credit than I think should go to it in our day-to-day lives, because a lot of our routines, our emotional responses happening with our reptilian brains. So
I think we like that, though, because we feel like we have some control over it.
Right, it does, yeah. And I'm not saying that we're all walking around like zombies. We do have control over our lives.
But there's a lot going on we don't know about.
There's a lot going on underneath that, which is where I think evolutionary psychology can kind of speak to that.
And we talked a little bit about evolutionary psychology in regards to fear, but is there evolutionary psychology in regards to things like empathy and, you know, when you see a baby crying, wanting to reach out to it? Have you studied all that as well?
Sure. You know, a lot of those kinds of things have been studied extensively also by evolutionary psychologists. Responses to infants actually is a really intriguing area of our field of study. So when you look at different species vary in terms of how altricial their offspring are. Altricial essentially means slowly developing. So like where I live in the Northeast, a baby deer will, at the end of day one, stand up and be walking around, right? But a baby human will be walking around maybe at 12 months, and then you still need an adult there, you know, 24/7 to make sure that everything's okay. So humans are very, very altricial. In fact, they talk about the first 3 months of life as the fourth trimester. So given how altricial our species is, a lot of the things that evolved in our social systems and our cognitive processes and how we deal with little ones is very keenly tied to factors that would have helped their survival. So one example is responses to babies crying. So we have a good friend, Rose Chang, who works for the American Psychological Association. Years back, she did this great research on looking at the acoustical properties of babies crying. And there's like this high, there's a lot of sort of up and down, high and low, and a high frequency kind of thing. And we respond to that. And in fact, if you hear sirens, human-made sirens, police, you know, ambulances, they actually mimic the baby crying. So it's something that, and there's research showing that whining, so when kids get a little bit older, whining, which of course none of us love, has those same acoustical properties. And there was actually a study done by Rose and her colleagues where one group listened to whining of kids in a language that wasn't even their own, versus it was like, I think, an electric saw that was broken and just kept like making the same annoying noise over and over. And the whining was hands down the most annoying that the people experienced. So it seems like there's this real natural tendency to respond to little ones in our species. And I think that's because of how much parental care they need. There's a lot of visual stimuli, visual features as well. So babies have relatively large eyes. The things that we see as cute are things that totally map onto little infants that need our help. And so we think puppies are cute. We have a friend, Dan Kruger, at the University of Michigan, who's done research on what species we think are cute and what species we don't think are cute. Species we think are cute and the ones that we want to have as pets and we take into our homes are ones that have, like, the big round face, that have the big puppy dog eyes kind of thing. And these are all, as ethologists or evolutionary psychologists might say, these are stimuli that are releasers. They release nurturing and sort of warm, helpful, supportive kinds of responses. And I'd say that that's all part of the evolutionary design.
And then there are also the people that want to have snakes as pets. That's
sure.
kind of an outlier.
It can be, yeah. I mean, so there's always going to be variance in these models. But, you know, in general, when you look at, like, snake responses, usually people, right. even the ones
snakes
that
snakes are not as popular as puppies.
Exactly,
for
right,
sure.
exactly.
There you
Exactly. So when we talk about these things, it sounds like you're talking about things that the general public kind of refers to as instinctive responses. How do instincts draw into the evolution of psychology?
Yeah, I'd say the question of instinct is a really interesting one. There are a lot of things that we study that I think map onto what we might call instincts, automatic responses, fear of snakes, fear of heights. We might think of these things as instincts. There are other things in that we can think of as our evolved psychology that are more complex, that we wouldn't really say are just immediate emotional instinctual responses. So one of my favorite theories in evolutionary psychology is the idea that the core principle of human uniqueness, the most compelling reason, or one of the most compelling reasons that humans evolved as we did, is because we are elite rock throwers. Now, that sounds kind of weird when you first hear it, but the theory put forth by Paul Bingham and Joanne Souza essentially says that one thing that stands humans apart compared to other primates is we have elite throwing abilities. Our bodies, our muscular system evolved that way. Our bone system evolved that way. If you see chimpanzees trying to throw sticks or rocks at some kind of predator, they do it very poorly.
I'm pretty bad, though.
A lot of people. Well, right,
not, I can't hit a mark.
If you work at it, and there actually is a male female difference on that. That's pretty robust. But an interesting thing about the human evolution on that is that about the same time that evolved, our ability to coordinate with members of our same species across kin lines evolved at about the same time, and that's one of the reasons that Homo sapiens really outperformed Neanderthals is because we were able to really create communities not just of our kin. Neanderthals pretty much had just kin in their little groups. But we have groups, of people working together that are not just kin. In early human evolution, if there was one dominant male who was kind of bossing everyone around, telling everyone what to do, you could get a group of little guys that were smart and working together as a team and just picked up a rock and, you know, would throw them. And that was really the first time in the history of the evolution of animals that individuals could exert large costs to a conspecific from a distance. So that's a really core aspect. And a lot of things in human psychology follow. That's partly why we're an egalitarian ape, or at least why we often work toward egalitarian systems. That's partly why democracy is something that emerges as the primary government structure in a lot of different societies. And I'd advocate that we should try to encourage that. So a lot of things follow. And a lot of the things that follow from that theory are not just like immediate emotional responses. So the evolutionary perspective can sort of help us understand sort of more complex psychological processes.
So you're looking at things more than just individual fears and those visceral reactions, but more the building of community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have we evolved pretty well there? Or
sure.
Where are we now, do you think?
Yeah.
And is it important to look at where we've come from to see where we might be going?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a great question. So I have a new book coming out that's going to be published with Oxford University Press. My second author is Nicole Wedberg, an alum of mine, a very strong researcher and writer. And the book is called Positive Evolutionary Psychology. And the entire point of it is about how can we use these ideas from evolutionary psychology to help advance the human condition. And a big theme therein has to do with understanding the nature of human community from an evolutionary perspective, and how can we make better communities? If there's a dysfunctional community, what steps might we want to take to make it better, and how can evolution inform that? one of the core ideas in this has to do with what's called Dunbar's number. So Robin Dunbar is a cognitive psychologist at Oxford University, famous for documenting when you look at human social cognitive processes. He came up with a number called 150 is Dunbar's number. 150 is about the cap of how many people in our world we're good at keeping track of, which totally maps onto the size of clans in nomadic societies and what were likely group size in humans before the advent of civilization and agriculture. In other words, our minds were probably adapted to know about 150 people. In addition to that, those 150 people that you knew under those kinds of conditions, which were the majority, which were in place during the majority of human evolution, were kin. You had about half those people were people you were related to. They were close kin. They were extended kin. Or they were part of your long-standing community, people that you were going to see every single day until one of you died. Nowadays, things are incredibly different. But from the evolutionary perspective, we really need to realize that the human mind really evolved to anticipate these small-scale group conditions, and we perform much better when parameters of any community map onto those kinds of evolved conditions.
When I think of that, and I think about our vast friend lists and followers and mm-hmm. social media, which is maybe not the same, but it is kind of fragmenting our ability to pay attention to the number of people. So are there immediate concerns as to, I mean, we've evolved to be 150, you said, to be aware and cognizant of 150 mm-hmm. people in our lives. When we stretch ourselves beyond that, has there been study of what happens? Is it possible for people to expand that?
It's a great question. I mean, right now I've gone over 1,000 in my friend list in Facebook, and while I love them all dearly, there are definitely people who like some of my posts that I'm like, I kind of forget who this person is, you know? So there's definitely something to this idea of it's hard to keep track of that particular number of people.
And I wonder what that says about globalization. I mean, everything's so globalized now, and we have so many connections across so many countries and cultures.
Yeah.
Is that something that's not sustainable if we haven't evolved to the point of being able to handle that?
Well, you know, my students and I published an article recently in the European Journal of Social Psychology, and it was on our evolved political psychology. We gave people two different tasks. One task was to write a paragraph about a made-up large-scale political situation, or write a paragraph about a small-scale political situation that you might find at work or in your family. And then we used some algorithmic computer writing analyzer to kind of see how did these differ from one another. And the very short version is, for the local small-scale political situations, people wrote in a very fluid manner. It was much more readable. It was at a much more basic reading level. When people were asked to write about a global kind of political situation, it took them more time, and what they wrote was messier, didn't make as much sense. It seemed like it was a more difficult task for them. And so I think that's evidence kind of consistent with what you're saying, that our minds, you know, from a lot of different angles, really not prepared to deal with this large-scale globalization thing that we have going on now. And this might partly be why modern-day politics and the modern world situation is such a mess.
Well, and it's becoming so fragmented when it spreads so thin. I mean, ideally, yeah, it'd be great for everybody to get along and to understand one another. But if we physiologically aren't there or capable of that, then it may not succeed and then possibly cause more problems than was ever intended.
I think that's correct. And I would totally agree with that statement. And I think that it's the evolutionary perspective that when you learn about this perspective, you can kind of step back and ask these questions and see things from this way. You know, traditionally, we've always thought more technology is better. Cell phones are a great example. So 50% of high school students in the country today will admit that they are addicted to their cell phones. And the other 50% are lying.
Yeah.
And when you look at addiction processes in the brain are identical. The brain circuits are identical if it's heroin or if it's tobacco or if it's cell phone use. So we now have what we're calling the I generation, the first generation of people in the history of our species who have had the internet available for their entire lives. And they're a natural experiment, you know, whether we like it or not. And one thing we know about these people on a college campus like this, Counseling centers are oversaturated. There are mental health problems are much higher than they've ever been among that generation in this country right now. And, you know, there are so many – everyone's mental health professionals and psychologists are all trying to ask why. And part of it, I think, has to do with the fact that this is a group of people that exist in the most mismatched – evolutionarily mismatched conditions that have ever existed.
Yeah, the condition being that the brain has evolved to a certain point, and then society and science and information and the net has really expanded far beyond what that brain has been evolved to handle, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so.
I see what you're saying there. It makes and it's comforting, sort of, to look at it through the eyes of evolution and science instead of looking at it from another perspective in which somebody might feel like they're being told that they're just not smart enough or they're not multitasking enough or they're not able to do that or they're, sure. they're lacking capability.
Yeah.
But basing it, couching it more in a study of the history and the evolution kind of makes it less accusatory, I suppose.
I think so. Right. I think so. And I think a really good example of what you're talking about there relates to an evolutionary perspective on education. Peter Gray at Boston College has become very famous for writing about this particular topic and studying it. But when you look at what education looks like in all pre-Westernized societies, nomadic societies around the world, any continent you find it, you find nothing that looks like what we have, which is everyone sitting in a desk. There's 30 of us. There's one 30-year-old woman in the front. We're with her for 8 hours a day, and then, you know, we go home. It's totally evolutionarily unnatural. So we have a lot of, you know, when we think about problem kids in our educational systems, right, and kids that need special programs and school psychologists have to intervene and psychiatrists need to intervene and there's drugs for attentional problems, that's if you step back, it's partly because, you know, not a problem with the kids, but it's a problem with the system, which is incredibly evolutionarily unnatural.
And I know I've been talking a lot with you, Dr. Greer, but I just wanted to also turn to Dr. Pipitone, who we've been sitting here chatting and you're just kind of nodding
no,
in agreement.
No, I'm just not. Yeah, it's
but,
just it's
you,
all.
When we talked before we started recording, you were talking about how you're more you studied a lot of interpersonal relationships and the evolution of different things that have gone on in the way that people are perceived and voices.
Sure.
I wanted to shift and talk to you about that also in light of the discussion we're having about the wider fragmentation of people's attention span.
So the lab that I come from has, you know, we do study, you know, mating behavior, sex differences, and how men and women, you know, view attraction and love. And those are all, you know, great topics, you know, symmetry, body characteristics, vocal parameters. And they're really great things. And I love investigating that. But I think if I can just go back to this real quick, I think, so the topics that I've traditionally focused on, evolutionary psychology, everybody views evolutionary psychology as that being the only aspect of the field, and it's not. And so, you know, while it makes good bar talk and people, I've never thought about this. This is really cool. Well, how does it affect me? How does it change my life? Well, I think when we step back, we can use, once we understand the mechanism of evolution and how it has shaped human behaviors, we can actually start to adjust things like public policy. We can adjust educational systems. And so I think there's a real utility in understanding evolution by natural selection. And students don't really understand the basic tenets, and it allows them not to really understand what we're talking about. So I think it's while the stuff that I have traditionally studied might not have a lot of utility in, you know, making you, you know, a better person or something like that, I mean, there is underlying, good information coming from that. But I think the larger picture is that, yeah, we have an evolved history. We are part of the biological realm. And so Dr. Gehr's work definitely is focusing on that in his book, which is really good, because I think evolutionary psychology does have that utility in affecting public policy. And, you know, this mismatch phenomenon is really something that's very interesting.
Yeah, you know, and before today, I never thought of it. You know, and I always thought of the only thing I know about evolutionary, the thinning of the herd thing, you know, the mm-hmm. strong survived kind of deal and things like that. I mean, we were kind of.
There's issues with that. Yeah. That's exactly, you know, and there's way more to it.
Right.
Yeah. And that's the only thing that I remember from studying it in college 25
years ago. So we're trying to bring it back. And evolution is not just studying, you know, Drosophila in the lab, to seeing, you know, genes evolve and those types of things. You know, humans are part of the biological world just like any other species. And so we have to consider our evolutionary history as well.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit more about your book. It's Positive Psychological Evolution.
Positive Evolutionary Psychology.
There it is.
Yeah. So when you look at evolutionary psychology in sort of the broader landscape of our society and within academia, kind of like Nate was saying, it's pretty famous for focusing on things like male-female differences and mating-related behaviors, you know, what do men want in relationships, what do women want in relationships. There's a whole bunch of other stuff in the field that's about really ugly things like homicide related to infidelity. There's a famous book by David Buss called The Murderer Next Door, which really gets into, you know, why the mind was evolved to kill under different conditions. Those are kind of nasty and ugly things. And a lot of people, to be honest, don't necessarily give evolutionary psychology a big hug, partly because of that, I think. And so this.
Yeah, but people still like to read that stuff. Is that whole navel gazing thing? You know, they want to look at it and then think, oh, but that's still not me. But this, what you're doing is taking more of a positive bend on things, which is rare, but definitely needed.
And that's essentially the idea. So, you know, I think that all that past work is great. I think the world of the researchers who've, you know, really made advances on those fronts. But I think that the world could really benefit from taking evolutionary psychology and its powerful framework and its powerful, like, way of asking questions and shedding light on what we might think of as the positive aspects of the human experience. So positive evolutionary psychology, and the subtitle is Darwin's Guide to Living a Richer Life, is exactly designed to sort of, you know, chapter after chapter, step by step, walk people through lots of different ways that evolutionary psychology can shed light on the positive parts of the psychological experience.
What is one positive takeaway that you'd like to leave people with after, for example, your talk that you did this week and this interview?
Sure. That I think that understanding, like Nate was saying, understanding ourselves as products of biological evolution, A, is really useful. And B, one of the core – there's lots of ideas in positive evolutionary psychology, but one of the core ideas has to do with what we think of as evolutionary mismatch, which we've kind of gotten into a little bit. Evolutionary mismatch exists when there are conditions now for some organism, and obviously we're thinking about it as with humans, although we can think about it with other animals. And this is why zoos don't work, by the way, because of evolutionary mismatch. But we think about it as the conditions for the organism now are very mismatched from the lion's share of the conditions during the evolution of that species. And when you have a mismatch, you can often have all kinds of problems. And when you step back from an evolutionary perspective, you can see that the ultimate cause of these problems does have to do with evolutionary mismatch. And that's really useful. Probably the most straightforward way to think about this is with human diet. So with human diet, before the advent of agriculture, all of our ancestors ever only ate natural foods. And they experienced drought and they experienced famine regularly, and because they experienced those things, they evolved preferences for foods that were high in sugar and high in fat, because under ancestral conditions, when famine was a reality of your everyday regular life, seeking out high-fat foods was going to be really adaptive. Well, that psychological process has been co-opted by the food industry now. And so now we can have McDonald's. We can produce what are called super normal stimuli, super sugary foods, super high fat foods, to the point now.
And that, salt. Yeah, the trifecta of salt,
yes,
fat, and sugar, right?
Exactly.
They have it down.
Yeah, yeah. And so an alum of mine gave a talk on this recently, which was really great. Her name's Mandy Guitar. She teaches classes in Darwinian medicine. She threw out a stat that I think is just very powerful, that we need to think about very seriously, which is that the percentage of food eaten by Americans in a given year that is unnatural, processed food, is about 62%. So a large majority of the food that we're taking in is stuff that is essentially we weren't evolved to eat. And so when we see problems with obesity, we see problems with type 2 diabetes, we see cardiac issues in societies like ours that you don't see in nomadic societies in Africa or in South America, well, guess what? It's because we live in such incredibly evolutionarily mismatched matched conditions. So if there's one quick takeaway from this idea of positive evolutionary psychology, it's to sort of wrap your mind around that idea and think about changes you might be able to make in your life that anticipate and take into account large-scale evolutionary mismatch.
Yeah, it's being aware of where some of the things have come from so that then you know how to address them instead of just putting a Band-Aid on a wound, right?
Correct, correct.
Gotcha.
Thinking about sort of the bigger picture explanation of what the problem is, which I think is what the evolutionary perspective allows us to do.
Do you think people will embrace that, or do you think people will shy away from it because it makes them feel small? That's a psychological question. Like, right?
I think it can go both ways. I think it could go, I tell students in my classes, evolution can mean everything and nothing, mm-hmm. but it depends on how you're looking at it, you know. And I think when you step back and see, you know, how we fit into this, it can mean it's, you know, it's evolution is embedded in every aspect of life on Earth. And so I think there's a real appreciation that you can grab from that. But then you can also go down that rabbit hole of, well, it doesn't really matter, you know, why am I here? You know, if I die, well, somebody else won't die and, you know, the process goes on or whatever. But I think in the end, having that better appreciation of where you fit into life, I think would be a positive thing.
Yeah.
It is to me, and I know that's probably not the case for other individuals, but I think once you get past, you know, maybe some of those initial, you know, fears, I think you would start to appreciate the larger picture.
And if I could just quickly add to that, you know, Darwin was a very, very quotable guy, and one of my favorites of his is that there is grandeur in this view of life. And, you know, for me, I'm obviously not religious. I'm the founding director of an evolutionary studies academic program, but I do consider myself in some ways strangely spiritual. And I think being an evolutionist gives you that. You know, it's like this amazing idea that we are interconnected, importantly, to the entirety of life, to all other people, to all other species. You know, when you go fishing on the surf on the coast and you are plucking out all kinds of species of fish there and you're watching the pelicans go diving in, and it's just like the evolutionary perspective allows you to sort of step back and say, I am so lucky to be part of this at all. So that's essentially how I see it.
That was Dr. Glenn Gehr and Dr. Nate Pipitone discussing evolutionary psychology. Our show today was produced by Rachel Iacovone. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. Changes, evolution, evolution.